Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Robert McGuire, registration number 37134. I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Marilyn Marks. Ms. Marks requests reversal of the trial court's dismissal of her complaint in this matter as a matter of law, and reversal of the trial court's deemed denial of her Rule 59 motion for amendment of that judgment. There are two overarching reasons. The first is that the district court erred in its construction of Article 7, Section 8 of the Constitution. And second, that the district court erred in construing a ballot storage provision of Title 31 as being an exception to the public's right of inspection under CORA with respect to the ballots and the ballot images that Ms. Marks sought to inspect. I'd like to take each of these points in turn, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Well, why don't you answer my preliminary factual question?
Sir.
How does this system, runoff work? Do they rank the candidates, and then it's whoever gets the lowest score wins? Is that?
Yes, it's something like that. What happens is this instant runoff system is used for the mayoral race and for two city council races. And the way it worked, voters essentially marked their first, second, third choices. And when they were done voting, the ballots at the end of the night were taken to a central tabulation center where the paper ballots were scanned through scanners by the city's vendor. That vendor, in scanning the original ballots into the system, created images of the ballots, which software that...
That's not my concern. I'm aware of that. Mm-hmm. But how does they determine by the number one votes who wins or who runs, and then the number two votes, and then how do they sort out to get a winner without a runoff?
It's a fairly complicated system, and
okay.
The way it works is if there's a winner at the beginning, someone who gets enough votes to win, and that person is the winner. But if not, after the first round of voting, if there's not a winner, you drop to the second choices. I think you drop a candidate off, and the votes for people's second choices who lost their first choice, those votes are then applied. And eventually, the winner accrues enough votes to win and is declared a winner. And so as part of that, it's a very complicated system. It's difficult to do by hand. And I think for that reason, the city had its vendor create these TIFF files to facilitate the counting process. And so it's actually a good lead-in, because importantly, the TIFF files, which are the records that we are seeking in this case, are not actual ballots. They are records that were created by the city clerk and her vendors in the course of tabulating ballots at the close of voting. The TIFF files were never touched by any voter. They were never seen by any voter. Effectively, they're intermediate records that were created in the process of tabulation.
Could they be modified if released?
They're digital scans. So for example, they could be modified to the extent that, say, a photograph might be able to be modified using a computer system. But the original ballots would still be there. And the original ballots, of course, are in the custody of the city.
And in this case, the TIFF files were in the ballot box?
Well, the TIFF files were placed in the ballot box along with the original ballots by the clerk on election night, from what we understand. Although it's not clear that that's required, the election statute only requires ballots to be placed in the ballot box and one copy of a tally sheet. And our sense is that these are more equivalent to tally sheets than to actual ballots. And so therefore, they are in the ballot box now, and that's...
And you say that you're talking about the TIFF
files. Yes, right.
Okay.
The CD.
The CD containing the TIFF files. And each file is an individual document on that CD. It's as though you're scanning photos or pages into a scanner, and each page creates a document. So the first basis on which the trial court held that Ms. Marks' complaint couldn't go forward as a matter of law was the constitutional provision for secrecy in voting. And that's taken from Article 7, Section 8 of the Constitution, which provides that you can receive votes using machine or mechanical contrivances so long as secrecy in voting is preserved. And that's really the only reference to secrecy in voting in the Constitution. But earlier in that section, there's...
Well, could I stop you a minute on that?
Yes, sir.
Clause, the purpose of receiving and registering the votes, these TIFF files would be for that purpose? Well, I mean, this was written a long time ago, this provision.
Yes. Originally, this provision was originally part of the 1877 Constitution. It was subsequently amended.
I don't think they were thinking about computers.
No, certainly not. But in this case, the votes are received when the ballots are cast by the electors. And the way the electors did that is they marked their preferences on actual pieces of paper, which they then deposited into ballot boxes where they placed in the mail and mailed in the traditional manner. And so that is the casting and receiving of votes.
You would agree registering and receiving within that provision of Article 7, Section 8 would apply to this, the TIF files, counting or what they did with the TIF files?
Well, I would agree that the TIF files are not... Well, the TIF files are essentially part of... They're like if you're keeping track of votes on a piece of paper by marking numbers. As long as secrecy in voting is preserved in the voting process, in the process of casting your vote, then secrecy in voting has been honored.
I'm not talking about secrecy in voting. I'm talking about... nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent the use of any machine or mechanical contrivance for the purpose of receiving and registering the votes cast at any election.
Oh, yes, yes. The TIF files, there's nothing...
That would fall within that idea,
yes,
perhaps.
We believe so. There's nothing wrong with using this system per se to receive and conduct the election. However, it's significant that the TIF files are not ballots because one of the two holdings that the trial court made in order to dismiss the complaint was to claim that the TIF files and the ballots are one and the same. The TIF files are essentially the same as ballots according to the trial court, and therefore a statute that requires the ballots be kept in the ballot box applies to the TIF files and is contrary to CORA according to the trial court. Now we disagree with that. We disagree also with the provision, with the idea that secrecy in voting bars the inspection of TIF files or, although it's not an issue in this case, the actual ballots themselves. And the reason for that is because the Constitution requires as a threshold issue that no ballots may be marked in any way whereby the ballot can be identified as the ballot of the person casting it. Now that's important because we're at the stage in a motion to dismiss where all the allegations in the complaint have to be taken by the trial court to be true, and all inferences have to be given in favor of the plaintiff. And in this case, the plaintiff alleged twice in the complaint that the underlying ballots were all anonymous.
Well, they were... Ms. Marks didn't go after the actual ballots, though.
Correct.
For CORA. Why?
Correct. Well, because her intention was to essentially trace through the election and see...
The complaint said she wanted to look into this new method.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, I mean, because it's complicated, it's a complicated system, and True Ballot, which is the vendor that ran the system, before the election put out a document which talks about how you can verify that the election was properly conducted. And there are several steps because in the course of counting, scanning ballots, extracting votes from them, applying the IRV rules to those votes, and producing a result, there are a number of steps that you have to be able to retrace in order to make sure that that was done properly, or at least to understand how it was done. And one of the things in that document, which was attached to the complaint that True Ballot put out explaining how you verify their election, is you compare the marks on the TIF files to the marks extracted by the software from the TIF files. And that's simply not possible to do unless you can look at the TIF files.
Now, is this a custom software for this? I mean, it was specially designed for Aspen?
The algorithm for extracting the votes and calculating the winners was designed for Aspen. But the process is one that this company has used before. From what I understand, they perform a lot of private elections for organizations, and it's a custom system that they have. It wasn't custom designed for Aspen, but parts of it were customized for Aspen. And incidentally, this is the first time instant runoff voting was ever held in Aspen, and so Ms. Marks, being the beneficiary of the new system, just wanted to go through and make sure that she understood it, because at the time, although I think it's since been repealed in Aspen, at the time, this was the manner of voting that Aspen was going to use going forward. And, you know, any person obviously who wanted to understand that would want to be able to see how it had worked. Now, an added complication, of course, which is mentioned in the facts, is that the vote totals were changed after the official tally and also 3 days after the deadline for filing an election contest. And so that, of course, added to Ms. Marks's curiosity about how and whether the system properly functioned. So the trial court ruled against us on two grounds. One was the Constitution and the idea that secrecy in voting is violated if you look at the actual face of a ballot. We think as a matter of law, that can't be right, because the Constitution requires that ballots not be marked in any way that they be identifiable. And there's no exception in there for the government to be able to have a ballot that's identifiable and just not release it to the public. If a ballot is identifiable to the government, then secrecy in voting has been violated, even if the public never has a chance to look at it. This is really one of those cases where if a tree falls in the forest, it really does make a sound. If a ballot has a mark on it that identifies it, the Constitution has been violated, regardless of whether the public is allowed to see that ballot. And in general, the entire concept set out in the Constitution of voting by ballot is that ballots are themselves intended to be a mechanism for anonymous political expression. They're intended to be anonymous, and that's why there should be no concern, certainly not as a matter of law in the context of a motion to dismiss, that someone can find out who voted a ballot simply as a matter of law. It's just,
well, let me ask, I don't know if you have an answer for this, but there seems to be a difference between the Municipal Elections Code and the statewide Uniform Elections Code on the preservation of election records. I mean, yes. Why is there such a difference?
Well, I don't have a definitive answer. I have an opinion, which is that the Municipal Election Code is out of date.
Old?
It's very old. Originally, there was one election code in Colorado. The Municipal Election Code was created around 1955. At that time, since that divergence, the two codes have been amended separately. The Municipal Election Code has been amended less than Title I. Title I is much more the focus of people's attention, and it's much more, it's, I would say, generally considered much more modern than the Municipal Election Code. They do have different requirements for preservation of ballots, and that's significant in this case because the ballot preservation requirement in Title 31 is the second thing that the trial court hung its hat on in ruling that Ms. Mark's case couldn't go forward. Even within the section that provides for ballots to be kept within the ballot box in Title 31, which is the provision at issue here, there's an exception if there's a special election. If there's a special election, you take the ballots out of the ballot box. And at that point, if the literal requirement that they shall remain in the ballot box is construed to be an exception to Cora, then right there you have an inconsistency within that very statute itself. If there's a special election, they're out of the ballot box. Do they then become subject to Cora? I would argue, under a literal approach, which is what was taken here, yes.
And is there anything in the requirements of storing of ballots and doing all these things that expressly says public inspection of them is not permitted?
There is nothing that says public inspection is not permitted. It's all inferred from this language that says they shall remain in the ballot box.
And then destroyed.
And then destroyed, yes.
That's mandatory language in the municipal code.
It is mandatory language, but interestingly, the requirement to destroy it doesn't happen until after 6 months, whereas the period for bringing an election contest is 10 days or something like that. And so you're left with a long period of overlap that, without any further insight into what the legislative intent here was, could just as easily be to provide a period of time after the ballots are not needed for contests in which people could inspect them. I mean, you can really, there's, because there is no ascertainable legislative intent.
Well, why would they want it, the ballots destroyed? I mean, that suggests at least they don't want people looking at the ballots.
Well, not necessarily. I think that it's a housekeeping requirement, as we stated in our brief. And the reason we think it's a housekeeping requirement is because you can find all kinds of examples throughout the law of requirements that documents be destroyed. In fact, the archive statute under which the state archivist works includes a requirement that records without historical value and a couple of other requirements shall be destroyed or disposed of every 2 years. If you're going to impose an obligation on someone to keep something, then you need to give them an opportunity to know when they no longer need to keep them. And I would say that that provision for destruction is a housekeeping requirement that does that.
Let me ask you one question. When there is a special election or a contest or a recount, are there statutory provisions that allow anyone other than a certified election judge to be in a room when there is recounting or when they're outside of the ballot box?
Well, the Constitution itself contains a very open-ended clause that says, in all cases of contested election, the ballots cast may be, quote, examined under such safeguards and regulations as may be provided by law. So the Constitution doesn't even limit who has to look at them in the case of contests. And we know from recounts, and we know from the rules involving watchers who can attend recounts, they're not sworn the same way election judges are. To the same things that election judges are. We know that lots of people see ballots in the course of public election contest proceedings, which are essentially judicial hearings in which the ballots themselves are evidence and become public. In fact, it's not just any.
But that's not the municipal code, the municipal elections code you're talking about, right?
Well, the municipal election code has a contest provision as well. And
but
so
these are, I mean, this seems like a bit different than the state code.
I think that in an election contest under the municipal code, obviously the contest is going to involve ballots, and that's going to be a proceeding that people are going to be allowed to attend and witness, and there's going to be evidence. And the ballots that are most in dispute are the ballots that are going to be the central evidence in any kind of contest. So right there, if in the situation where the most sensitive ballots are ultimately going to be exposed to public scrutiny, it's hard to then rationalize that ballots otherwise generally shouldn't be subject to public scrutiny, particularly in light of the requirement that they must not be marked in a way that allows them to be identified. There's just no harm that comes from it, certainly not to secrecy in voting.
Thank you, Council. You're out of time, but because I asked you some sort of preliminary questions, I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please the court. My name is James R. True, registration number 9528. I'm special counsel for the city of Aspen. With me at council table is John Wooster, the city attorney. We represent Catherine Cook, the city clerk for the city of Aspen. At the outset, we must note that whenever there's a discussion regarding the release of ballots or their images or inspection of ballots, the initial reaction is invariably, why not? After all, they're just pieces of paper with little ovals filled in by the voters. The name of the voter is not on the ballot. There's no number on the ballot that identifies a particular voter to a particular ballot. They are given to the voter anonymously. On the surface, it would appear appropriate, and we recognize some of the questions lead you that way, but I'll explain why not very clearly. The most direct answer is that it is contrary to the plain language adopted by the state legislature. That is in 3110.616. It's a legislative directive that is based on our Constitution and the present mandate to conduct all elections by secret ballot. Now, to back up a bit to answer some of the questions about the facts of this case, this was an instant runoff voting election. People had a chance to fill in the ovals in their ballots, ranking candidates. If your first choice was candidate A, then you ranked them number one. If candidate A was your second choice, you ranked them number two. To count this election in the system that was developed for the city of Aspen, the ballots were fed into a scanner, and a digital photograph of that ballot was created. And then computer programs were used to tabulate the results and come up with an instant voter without the need for a runoff election. But these are photographs. These TIFF images we're talking about are photographs of the ballots.
And those were shown to the public on election night?
A few of those were.
How many?
Many of them were.
It sounded like a lot of them.
Many were. They were flashed on the screen for seconds, but only a portion of them. And we acknowledge that was done. This was an effort to conduct the most transparent election in Colorado history. And the city of Aspen feels it complied with that intent to be as transparent as possible. That is, allow the public to look at how this instant runoff voting, the first one in the state of Colorado, would work. And so they were broadcast on. We acknowledge that. Some portions of many of the ballots were broadcast. The full ballot was only broadcast in a couple of instances.
Well, at the counting center, it's my impression all of the ballots were run by on screen.
No, I don't believe that is that is accurate. We don't mind admitting that for the case of this Rule 12b-5 case. I don't believe that was accurate. Not all ballots were shown on the screen.
But how is the rule of secret balloting defeated or compromised by releasing the TIF files?
Well, that's the underlying question here in this case. And there are any number of ways.
I asked.
Yeah. There are any number of ways in which this issue can be, that can cause problems or violate the secrecy of the ballots. One is people marking them, intentionally or unintentionally. And there are many examples that have been discussed over the past year about how unintentional marks can come onto a ballot. A judge eating a piece of chocolate, smudging the ballot, and handing it to a voter. This actually has happened. There's a smudge on that ballot that wasn't noticed to the voter until it went into the machine. That ballot is then marked.
Mr. Chu, the TIF file is not the ballot.
That's correct, but the TIF file is a photograph of the ballot, and that smudge would be on that TIF file.
Only that voter would know whose vote that is.
No, that judge would know.
Might know.
The judge would know, the voter would know, but the judge knowing violates that voter's right to a secret ballot. And there are other examples that we have recognized as we study this. It's not just marking. We'll recognize that it's illegal to mark. So you can have illegal intentional efforts, by whether it's a spouse marking the absentee ballot of the other spouse so you can see how his spouse voted.
Well, can we assume for purposes of this proceeding that no ballots are marked in any way where anybody could?
Well, I think it's appropriate to assume under Rule 12b-5. But that
you could delete them. You could delete those ballots.
I'm sorry?
You could delete those ballots.
The marked ballots?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps, but there are other ways that the secrecy can be violated, not just by marking ballots. In this, I believe, addresses one of the questions that was raised by your honors, is that why is there a difference between municipal elections and
I was about to ask you that, so.
Well, one of the reasons is that municipal elections are traditionally quite small. You're running the.
Well, this is your opinion, or do you have some kind of authority to tell us that? Why there is such a difference? Yes.
No, this is I believe our analysis of why the municipal code and the state code went in different directions, and it's not exactly accurate that 3110616, the primary basis for our position that you cannot release these ballots, more than just a storage provision. This is a secrecy directive by the legislature to destroy ballots. But municipal elections run the gamut from the large cities, Fort Collins, Denver, Colorado Springs, Pueblo, to small municipalities. City of Aspen has 2,544 voters in this last election. And that gets to one of the reasons secrecy may be compromised by releasing ballots. If you have a small number of people voting for one candidate, which does happen in these city elections, and all of them voted in a particular way, for other candidates that they did not address how they were voting, but they addressed how they were voting and there were only a few of them, it takes very little to determine that these people who were vocal supporters of this candidate now have voted this way for other candidates. That's a violation of secrecy, and that is what 3110.616.1a is definitively designed to prevent. The language of 3110.16.1a is very clear. The ballots are to be preserved in the box till the period for a contest is over or 6 months, and then they shall be destroyed. This is not just a convenience for preservation of space. This is a preservation. It's a security method to prevent the violation of secrecy in our elections. And if you look at the terms of the code, even that, that provision that the plaintiff has argued is just a mundane provision of taking the ballots out to get the boxes to use in a special election while a contest is going on, the state legislature said very clearly, as long as it's assured that no voter's vote can be determined. So you can't
I mean, that seems to me to be the crux of the secrecy.
Correct.
Determining whose vote is which. Now, even with the TIF files, if you wanted to be forensic about it, you'd get fingerprints off the ballot itself. Can't do that on a TIF file, correct. I assume. So, I mean, absent the judge smudging chocolate on the ballot, which is the only example so far you've given by finessing to Judge Furman's question, what is pernicious about this request? I don't, quite frankly, understand it.
Well, first of all, by arguing that TIF files, these photographic copies, are different from the ballots, in essence, eviscerates all privacy laws. In all the arguments about WikiLeaks, I dare say not one person has, in defense of that young soldier who's in jail for these leaks, has argued that it was okay or legal because these are electronic copies. They're the same thing. So any marking that occurs, whether it's the smudge, whether it's intentional, whether it's unintentional, whether it's a write-in ballot, remember, people can vote write-ins. And in Aspen, you don't have to declare your write-in candidacy. You can just be written in. If somebody announces, I'm voting for X as a write-in candidate, and I'm strongly supporting him, I'm the only person that does it, it's easy to then identify the rest.
So, but you would agree that there is no ballot that shall be marked in any way where that could be identified for purposes of this proceeding?
Correct.
I mean, that's unique right. Handwriting and writing somebody in, I don't see how, I mean, that wouldn't apply here.
Well, I don't understand why it wouldn't apply. It's a legal procedure to write in a candidate. It is identifying a supporter of that.
Handwriting is unique, isn't it?
Pardon?
Isn't handwriting unique?
Handwriting
or could be?
Handwriting could be unique, but under this circumstance, it would be identifiable. Ms. Marks, in her complaint, tried to carve out write-ins. It's similar to redacting other markings. She tried to carve out write-ins, but the preservation statute and the direction to destroy these ballots does not, or CORA, does not suggest you can carve things out of it. You have to keep the ballots, or the clerk has to keep the ballots in the box until they're destroyed.
Okay, well, given the request that there's the carve out, what secret is out if they were released under the Open Records Act?
Well, she's carving out things you know about. Mm-hmm. You're not necessarily carving out things you don't know about. Again, going back to a candidate that receives a small number of votes and trying to analyze how they voted, whether your oval has a little curly cue under it, whether you, in very typical people, don't realize you're supposed to fill it in at first, so they mark an X and then go back and fill it in. Is that innocent, or is that a marking trying to project how they voted? It is not known. What the state...
But you have to connect. What would be wrong, for instance, with an order that said, Ms. Marks, you can't... We're not going to give you a disc to take home, but you can come into the office and you can go through those ballots as long as you want. But you got to do it in the office. You got to do it on our machine, so you can't copy anything. Just do it in our office. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's the same issue, Your Honor. You're allowing somebody, one person, to violate the secrecy obligations with no restrictions that she can't go over. And I figured
but,
out this.
But counsel, the chances of someone, I mean, I don't know, but the chances of someone looking in the clerk's office at the ballots to run whatever survey or study she wants to run with respect to this system, and she can't take anything out of the office. She's just write down the numbers. I don't see that is so terribly remote that she would know, see a mark, that she would know whose mark it is, and she'd be able to say that it was your ballot. I I just don't see that as even as the very slimmest of possibilities.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, and I think what the legislature did was enact legislation to say 616 requires the ballots to stay in the ballot box and then be destroyed. There's no logical reason for it other than to protect the secrecy that's decided by the Constitution. This state adopted, along with all the other states in this country, the constitutional amendments to preserve secrecy and balloting. And the Constitution says...
And accuracy.
I'm sorry?
And accuracy in the count.
Absolutely. There's no argument about accuracy. But
well, it seems to be here.
Well,
I mean, there seems to be concern that this rather novel system that has never been applied in an election might not be working right.
But Taylor versus Pyle says that you, just because there's an assertion that there's inaccuracy, even the courts won't open a ballot box to recount the ballots.
No, they wouldn't want to give anybody the information they need to make that allegation, would we?
Well, if they don't have any information than would exist in this case with whether somebody is reporting fraud. There has to be evidence of fraud. There's no evidence of fraud that's been...
Well, there's evidence of a computer program that nobody understands, apparently.
Oh, I disagree with
well,
that.
Maybe the vendor understands. The vendor have a copy of these TIFF files, by the way?
No, they've been destroyed, according to the vendor. And
you don't know that, though. They just told you that's true.
Correct.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, understand something. The TIFF files generated what we call strings. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If I voted for candidate A, number one, that shows up as one, and then my second choice is two, that shows up as two, and there are these little files, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's a computer program that runs those. That information was released. Every test of those documents, and it's well accepted in this case, every test of those strings, as we call them, have been run, have been tested, and have confirmed the results. So there is no question as the accuracy. I see that my time's up. I would request that you uphold the trial court's dismissal of this case. Thank you.
You have 1 minute, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to emphasize that there's a distinction to be made between a unique ballot and an identifiable ballot. Uniqueness can come from anything. It can come from a fold on the corner. It can come from a unique set of choices made on that ballot. The fact that a ballot is unique is a prerequisite for it to be identified. But the fact that it is unique is not sufficient to enable it to be identified. In order to enable it to be identified verifiably, someone has to be able to tell you before anyone else knows what's on there, there's a ballot that's mine that has a coffee stain in the shape of a teardrop on the top right corner. That's a believable claim if no one else has any access to the ballots. But if the ballots are all publicly released, that claim could be made by anyone, and there's no way that it can be verifiable. And so therefore, the fact that a ballot may be unique in any sort of way, even if it's from handwriting, if it's from a curlicue, doesn't mean anything about whether it's identifiable. And in this case, in the context of a motion to dismiss, we have to assume that they're all anonymous because that's what was pled, and that's also what the Constitution requires. And furthermore, there's been no showing whatsoever that any of these individual TIFF files do contain information that would make those underlying ballots identifiable. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them otherwise. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel for your briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.